I am Charlie Bennett, and this is the North Avenue Lounge. Welcome to the North Avenue Lounge. This is a fourth in the occasional and informal series, What's in a Word, where my friend and former colleague, Dr. Ian Offlerbach, comes into the studio. We take a word and we unpack it to various levels of explanation. Welcome back to the show, Ian.
Thanks. Thanks for having me again.
Great to have you here. We have talked about liberalism, the word. We've talked about postmodernism, the word. We cheated and did a phrase, public humanities.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And now we're going to go maybe, if not from the sublime to the absurd, then maybe from the serious to the personal.
Yeah, yeah, from the general to the particular, yeah.
Today's word is Pynchonesque. Can you start with what is your relationship to the word Pynchonesque?
Oh, so immediately I think about those few authors whose style becomes so idiosyncratic that it sticks in our head. And I think especially someone who does this both for fun and professionally, I am really interested in what it is about an author and the way that they write that makes them sound like them immediately and allows you to adjective their name like this, Pynchonesque. And there's not that many authors you do this with.
Yeah.
You could say Dickensian and people get that. Yeah. You know, there's a few.
And Kafkaesque and Orwellian are more about subject than they are about style.
Yeah, to some degree.
Yeah.
Although, yeah, no, I think that's right. There is something very particular. There are a lot of authors who have very definite style, but you never really get a Henry James has a very definite style, but people don't really go around calling things Jamesian all that often.
Yeah.
So it is. It's rarefied air to have your own adjective based on literary style. It's an interesting question.
Very nice. So the Pynchon in question is Thomas Pynchon or Pynchon. How do you say it?
Pynchon.
Pynchon.
Yeah.
I hear that that's incorrect, but it's so satisfying to say Pynchon.
I think that's right. Yeah. I think it's wrong with satisfying.
Yeah. I'm going to give you all a very quick biographical sketch of Pynchon. Partially because we don't need to get into the biography, and also partially because there's not a lot to be told.
Right.
He was born in 1937, so this is a great white male author that we're talking about. He is a New Englandie, right, both in his birth and his education, but he also worked at Boeing for a little while as a technical writer. And once he started publishing, he avoided the press. To the point where George Plimpton called him in the Paris Review a recluse living in Mexico City, which might have just locked him in at that point.
Yeah.
You know, I can almost imagine him saying, if you're going to call me a recluse I'll be.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
But there's not much photographic evidence of Pynchon. There's not much, there are hardly any interviews. In fact, I don't know that there are any interviews unless some of them appear to be gags.
Right, right. And there's a couple of informal encounters that have become part of the mythos.
Right.
Him and Salman Rushdie sitting down, I think, after the fatwa. You know, some of these, but not like written Paris review kind of exchanges.
Yeah. And there's also the occasional sort of sideways reference to Pynchon. There was a Playboy article, who is Thomas Pynchon and why did he run off with my wife?
Yeah.
And no one knows how much of that is true and how much of it is not true. Steven Weisenberger seems to have a few details that he appears to pull from thin air.
Yeah.
Like when he describes the writing desk of Gravity's Rainbow as having a model rocket and a pig.
Right.
A model pig.
Yeah.
And the engineer's paper.
The whole thing having been written on graph paper. Yeah. Right, exactly. Yeah.
Do you have a thought on the truth of that, the validity of that?
I don't. You know, I think the true or falseness is less interesting than the way the mythos has been built up around these little anecdotes that everyone circulates again and again of whether or not they're exactly accurate.
Yeah.
He was at Cornell and famously took a class with Vladimir Nabokov, who then said he never remembered him. But then Nabokov's, which Nabokov would say whether it was true or not, right?
Right.
But then Nabokov's wife says that she does remember him based on the handwriting.
Huh.
Which again, I mean, true or false, it's become part of the legend. Yeah.
And none of this would matter if it weren't for the fact that Pynchon has written at least two, possibly three, internationally famous books.
Right.
There is no escaping the reputation of the book Gravity's Rainbow from 1973 and the book The Crying of Lot 49 from 1966. I, you know, I probably have it written down here, 1966. So his career started with V, a novel, in 1963. He had a few short stories. And then he, you know, wrote for 40, 50 years and produced a few more books, like hardly anything. And we don't know much about him. Gravity's Rainbow is a shocking book and a very important book, even if you haven't read it, right? And then Pynchon exists. There was a brief burst of Pynchonia when Inherent Vice, the film based on his more recent book, mm-hmm. Inherent Vice, came out. But there's not a lot about him. There's a tremendous amount about his writing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Although I will say there is a kind of a constant interest in him precisely because of how little we know.
Yeah.
So there's only a few authors who have so insistently avoided the celebrity or even the status of like the public intellectual that comes from being a recognized author.
Who are the others that you can think of?
The name that leaps to mind is J.D. Salinger, as a kind of noted recluse.
But he was allowed to tell people why he was a recluse, didn't he? Didn't he kind of have a statement of, I just don't want to be bothered? And like he was sort of a persona who then pulled away.
Yeah.
And Pynchon tried to not even have a persona.
Right. And I think that if you look at Salinger's style of a kind of mid-century anxiety intellectualism, search for spiritual meaning, you can see, oh, right, I can see why this person doesn't want cameras in their face. Pynchon, as someone who's always on the ball of pop culture and interested in the high and the low, it seems more willful.
Right.
It doesn't seem as necessary to this person, or at least the projection of what we imagine this person
to be. It seems almost like a gag.
Yeah.
Because he also gave permission to be represented on The Simpsons.
The Simpsons a couple times, yeah.
Yeah. And in fact, it is infamous for saying that he could not possibly deliver a line that was bad-mouthing Homer.
Right.
Because that's his...
role model.
Role model, yeah. Yes. Thank you.
Yeah.
All right. So, Thomas Pynchon. An American author, the author of the novels V, The Crying of Lot 49, Gravity's Rainbow, Vineland, Mason and Dixon, Against the Day, Inherent Vice, and Bleeding Edge. Mm-hmm. Also a collection of short stories, Slow Learner, mm-hmm. with kind of the most personal writing that people can find.
Yeah.
He wrote an essay at the beginning of it
talking
about becoming a writer.
Yeah.
Mostly about his flaws.
Yeah, it's a really... I think really honest kind of description of what he sees as the failures of those early stories is every writer's figuring out what they're doing early on, and he hasn't come back to the short story.
No.
So it's not, it's only, there's only so much you can say that it's formative, but yeah, really kind of honest, even scathing description of what he doesn't like about them.
Most people say he protests a little bit too much, you know.
Yeah, but... I also don't know that the stories hold up all that well either.
Oh.
Yeah. I mean, they're trial runs for something bigger. Yeah.
I should remind everyone or inform everyone, Ian is an English professor. he grades everything.
Yeah. Well, I also think in terms of things like teachability. So when I say hold up, I don't just mean my own aesthetic judgment. Like, would I ever put this in front of 18, 19-year-olds, 20, 21-year-olds? That's a kind of teacherly criteria for me.
Yeah. We'll get back to teaching for sure.
Yeah.
So, Pynchon, what was your introduction to Thomas Pynchon?
I was introduced to Thomas Pynchon in a college course I was taking. I think it was just called Postmodernism. And, you know, that was part of what breathed a lot of life into those books, I think, among academics, was all the enthusiasm, which we've covered in great detail, for postmodernism. And Pynchon seemed to fit so well with so many of those interests.
Yeah.
The kind of dissolving of traditional characters and individuals, interest in mixing high and low. We'll get into all the idiosyncrasies of his style, but so he fit in that class. But also, he stood out. Like, I barely remember any of the other books we read in that class. It's been a long time. But we read The Crying Lot 49, and man, did that stick with me.
Yeah. Can you remember why? Well, I mean, obviously you remember the book, but what do you think was doing the work on you?
There's something so knowing about the way that book is written. It's so incredibly smart, but it's also a wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
Yeah.
It's a gag. It's conspiracy theory, but not serious. But it might be. It's this really strange, it's kind of like an inside Dopester feeling.
Yeah.
Where you get to feel like you're both in a joke, but constantly pursuing what the point of that joke is.
Right.
That I think for a certain kind of reader is intoxicating.
Yeah.
Because you get to have your intellect scratched, but you also feel like you're constantly chasing something's tail and you never quite get there. And that, for me, like I think many other people who encounter that book, sends you off on a spiral of reading all the other Pynchon to try to find it out. Yeah.
Yeah. I remember encountering Pynchon as a reputation and a brand for a long time before finally pulling Crying of Lot 49 because it was the smallest book.
Right, which is considerably the smallest book. Yeah.
It's tiny. It is a long short story in a lot of ways. I pulled Crying of Lot 49 off the library shelf from amongst all the other ones.
Yeah.
I knew not to try Gravity's Rainbow because it had been compared to Finnegan's Wake.
Right. Oh, okay.
I'm a 19-year-old kid in this story.
Sure.
So I read Crying of Lot 49, and I don't think it's any secret that I was a young man in the 90s and that I smoked a ton of dope and was anti-authoritarian.
Yeah.
And so I lit up. He was wired in to what I thought was important.
Yeah.
And The Crying of Lot 49 has it's a mystery story. Right?
Yeah.
And I love the phrase inside Dopester kind of feeling because it's very knowing. It's a third person narrative that's very sort of subjective and inside Oedipus's head. It's lunatic, the jokes and the sort of low slang and grossness and silliness that is inside what becomes a somewhat... not terrifying, but an insinuating sort of fear of a woman who finds herself uncovering a deeper and deeper conspiracy that runs not the world, but runs a certain kind of world.
Right. Yeah. And there's within the book itself an uncertainty about whether this is the most important thing that she could possibly be doing, or whether it's just nothing at all.
Right, whether it's just a joke that someone put together to mess with, an ex-lover put together to mess with her after he died.
Yeah. And so again, I think for a certain kind of mind, especially 1819, that way of thinking about the world, is there everything? Is it all connected? Is there really a thread to pull? Or is it just noise? You know, is it just this collection of strange different pieces and references cobbled together? And Pynchon just suspends those two. You don't get an answer. That's important. I mean, don't go reading the book like you're going to get a resolute, you know,
even result. The ending, which feels so weighty, doesn't seem to have any particular significance. It's a beautiful little poem in its own way. So Crying of Lot 49... was my introduction, and then I attempted, I think it was Vineland that I attempted next and just didn't continue. So then years and years and years went by.
Yeah.
How about you right after Crying Lot 49?
Right after Crying Lot 49, I think I started, as I said, a spiral of reading everything that he had written up to that point. And so I went back to V and read V and then read Gravity's Rainbow and then Mason and Dixon and Against the Day and then found Slow Learner. So I did a huge kind of, back when I had the stamina for such things.
Against the Day is an 1,100 page book.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
It's enormous.
Gigantic.
We'll get back to that. I waited a long time until finally someone... I watched Inherent Vice in the theater because I'm a huge fan of Paul Thomas Anderson.
Yeah, it's a great movie.
And it's a really good movie.
Yeah.
And it's got that Crying of Lot 49 feel. Did any of that matter?
Right.
What are we uncovering?
Right.
I said, I should read some Pynchon someday. I should do that. And I was talking to a friend about watching the movie. And he said, he's an English professor also. He said, yeah, I need to go back and reread all that stuff. I never read Inherent Vice. I should reread Gravity's Rainbow. In fact, a student and I are doing an independent study. We're going to read Gravity's Rainbow. I said, can I get in on that?
Yeah.
He said, yeah.
Yeah.
And I should have known from the way he said it.
Yeah.
So then I read Gravity's Rainbow over the course of 4 months. And when we started, we were reading 90 pages a week.
Yeah.
And I came in after 2 weeks and said, I can't do it. Yeah. I cannot do it. And they said, no, none of us can. We're going down to 60 pages a week and we're knocking out Inherent Vice and we're not even going to read the Duino elegies.
Yeah.
And I finished it. And I would not have finished it if someone had not been pulling me along.
Yeah.
Did you have someone pulling you along?
I had a sadistic English professor who, in a later seminar, assigned Gravity's Rainbow over Spring Break, and he said,
"Lord,"
he said very honestly, "Look, I know that only 3 or 4 of you are going to read this anyway, and so I'm giving those 3 or 4 people the time to do it, and not even pretending that the others are going to." And I mean, like he, yeah, I mean. As a teacher, it's not behavior I would emulate, but again, that was a signal of the kind of like cult of being an insider.
Right.
Like, Gravity's Rainbow is a book people talk about a lot more than they do read.
Yeah.
Or what's the phrase? It is a book talked about much more often than read. Right? I guess that's the right way to put it.
I used to joke. I said, look, no one's read Gravity's Rainbow. Mm. Anybody who tells you that they read Gravity's Rainbow is a liar. And then someone said, well, that can't be true. I said, no, start from there.
Yeah.
And then test them.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And now I'm one of those people.
Yeah.
I've read it.
Yeah. And you get to have those conversations that, again, build that kind of sense of, you know, if I say banana pancakes.
Right.
Yeah. It is, in fairness, it's worth saying, since you started by mentioning his reputation, that's the book that comes up in arguments about the great American novel. For people who care to have such arguments, that's the one that gets referenced.
Yeah, that could be the American Moby Dick.
Right.
I'm joking, of course, because it wasn't until England caught on to Moby Dick that it became the great American novel.
Yeah.
But, it could be a post-war... post-Holocaust Moby Dick in its own way.
Yeah.
You read it in the week, Gravity's Rainbow?
Yeah. The first time I read it
so
in
you read
a week.
100 and something pages a day. 100
something pages a day, yeah. Yeah, it gives you an idea of my social life as a junior in college that I spent spring break reading Gravity's Rainbow at like 150 pages a day, yeah.
And was that after, so that was the next thing. In the same course?
It was part of the sequence, yeah. That's all within a year, and then I think the summer I just continued to blaze through the rest of the books, and yeah.
Is there anyone else that makes you think of Pynchon?
So the authors that make me think of Pynchon? Huh. I do associate him with a kind of crop of, you mentioned jokingly, the like great white male authors. There's a handful of kind of mid 1970s, 1980s, kind of white male aesthete, mm-hmm. by which I mean kind of returning to a heavy emphasis on style and writing rather than social realism or what now gets called middle brow. I don't like that term at all, but...
What is middle brow? I know that you don't like it, but what would middle brow mean, do you think?
Like they're interested in... families and the anxiety that comes from like being middle-aged. Do you know what I mean? Like very relatable, humanist, but that's part of where the judgment comes from.
Are we
condescension
talking about
to
Updike.
Updike, yeah. Updike is the weird in between because he wrote in such heavily stylized purple prose about all these about being an old white guy who's not young anymore and can't play basketball. So he's kind of the worst of both worlds. or Jonathan Franzen for a more contemporary version.
Now, I don't think either one of those authors has the kind of lunatic verbal ecstasy that Pynchon has.
No, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that's hard to match.
Yeah, I can't think of. I mean, I think there are some stand-up comedians who operate in the same way that Pynchon's writing does, like the literal word choice and sentence structures.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's interesting. Lenny Bruce.
Yeah, even early Patton Oswalt. He was a young man, and his associations were so fiery. You know, and he would reference a cultural event, and he would reference a cartoon, and he would reference a comic book, and he would reference a movie, and it would, you know, all at once. But yeah, I can't think of anyone else whose writing feels like Pynchon's, even if their themes feel like his.
Right. I will say one of the people he gets compared to often is Joyce, and that's in part because of the length and the difficulty of the books. But I do think what Joyce does in Ulysses, anyway, is mix high and low and mix the kind of deep mythic seriousness about the human condition with, you know, scatological jokes.
Right.
And Pynchon does that too, but Joyce feels just old enough to us in style that the jokes don't quick click in the same way, and we don't have access to Homer in the way that he did. So I would say there's continuity there, but it's a little harder to see.
Yeah. So let's get into the meat of it.
Right.
Right. After reading Gravity's Rainbow, I did feel like my mind had been expanded, which is a lovely joke for a lot of people. Like, oh, yeah, your mind's expanded. But I felt that way, you know. I felt changed afterward. And so that kind of, that sent me on my trip, started reading his other stuff. I read V, attempted a couple other things. I read Inherent Vice. So now we're here to try and talk about what have we gleaned? What have you and I, and then, and how does that reflect on sort of other things that we read? What makes Pynchon Pynchon, and what makes him the writer that we feel willing to give an hour over to just talking about him?
Yeah. Well, I'll start by coming back to the adjective Pynchon-esque.
Yeah.
What makes him sound like him? And even in the books that aren't Gravity's Rainbow, they sound like him.
Yeah.
And so what is that thing? I think he has enormous range in the construction of his sentences and the tonal variety that he can bring to a single page. So there's slapstick comedy. I mean, old school Marx Brothers, Abbott and Costello kind of silliness. There's Gravity's Rainbow is, among other things, a 700-page dick joke, right?
I might have to bleep that out.
Okay. I wasn't sure. Yeah. It doesn't, there's no other phrase for that.
Right. So it's a genitals joke.
It's a genitals
if
joke.
If necessary to.
Yeah. It's the mixture of high and low that comes to mind first for me.
A Greek myth recapitulated in a toilet.
Right. That starts after a Tupperware party. Gravity's Rainbow is a novel about colonialism and race and a kind of voracious white male gaze and the military-industrial complex, but it's also about a guy who dresses up in a costume and runs into stand-up comics and has goofy conversations and doesn't quite know what he's doing at this party and has to make an awkward exit. And the sheer clash between the individual sentences, between the set pieces, it feels capacious and unsettled and ambiguous, but rich. It feels like the world you live in that's so serious and important, but also so ridiculous. That Pynchon-esque style to me is trying to keep one foot in each version of looking at the world that way.
Yeah.
And when he does it well, it's incredible.
So Gravity's Rainbow, he does it well. I mean, and it's hard to say why. You just know once you finish it, I was there. Even though there was a toilet ship in the middle of it, I am devastated by the relationship between Blissero and his partners. In Crying of Lot 49, or even V, there is that kind of freedom of the language and that sort of, I want to say precision, but it's control more than precision. Because even when it's all over the place, even when he's talking about ridiculous things or he's doing a run-on sentence on purpose or using sort of pronunciations, like a th apostrophe or your, I think, as instead of your.
Oh yeah, he does all kinds of dialects.
Yeah. And, yeah. As the narrator, yeah. You know, writing the dialect yeah. in the actual, all of those things are sort of ecstatic little writing tricks. But then in V, mm-hmm. it seems like a very elegant book also, instead of the wild and woolly book of Gravity's Rainbow. So what's happening in the, and V, of course, is before Gravity's Rainbow, has a character in it that's a direct line, and then the Herero, I'm probably saying that wrong, but the African tribe is referenced
yeah.
In V that is then explicated
right.
in Gravity's Rainbow.
Right.
It's almost like V is the sport coat, you know, before he loosens his tie and gets a little drunk to
yeah.
write Gravity's Rainbow.
But it's also hard because all of his books have those competing centripetal and centrifugal urges. Is it all ordered? Will it all come together? Will there be a pattern? Or is it chaos and madness?
Yeah.
And that's the position you're thrust in, but it's also what the books are doing. But some of the books, it's hard because do you want closure in your reading experience?
Right.
Are you willing to read 1,100 pages of Against the Day if that book doesn't really ever get somewhere with its mystery? And so Pynchon can almost also be enormously frustrating
yeah.
for people.
The, you know, a shaggy dog story in the classic sense is a story that has no end, has no purpose. And the joke or the competition is how long can you keep it up? Before someone says, "What are you talking about?" And Pynchon does seem to have that. You know, even we're talking about Crying of Lot 49, ending it with a sort of,
yeah,
as opposed to an explosion. V ends with just another episode, right, of these sort of back and forth time traveling episodes. Benny Profane, yeah. who is our character who's introduced at the beginning, doesn't seem to be all that important at the end.
Right, right.
Gravity's Rainbow, he actually dissolves his main character.
Yeah, yeah. And again, when these conceits, when these ideas feel like they're part of what the book is diagnosing, then it can be incredible. It can yeah. upset your idea of what a novel is and what a protagonist should do and be. And I think it does that in Gravity's Rainbow. When Tyrone dissolves, you realize he's not been the point. But in some of the other books, and Against the Day is, I think, the easy one to pick on, being 1,100 pages, when the normal Pynchonian choice of having 300 to 500 characters within a single
right,
book,
right.
When that no longer seems like it's achieved, like it's creating a very particular set of effects, it just seems like static. It can be frustrating. It can be frustrating to not be able to keep track of any of these people and not know who matters, and then you feel like none of them matter. And then, right?
Martin Amis has a thing he said about Joyce. You know, there are very few literary geniuses, maybe Joyce, and arguably Joyce was a drag about half the time.
Yeah.
And I feel like that connects to Pynchon.
Yeah.
You know, that like it is impossible to not be amazed by his work, even in the midst of, say, a terrible book. I say a terrible book, a book that does not succeed. But then also, it feels like, oh, I had to get through it.
Yeah.
Like, I had to, Gravity's Rainbow was homework. It was literally homework.
Yeah, right.
And I enjoyed it, but I also needed it to be homework to be able to read it.
Right.
Why do you think that we enjoy the difficulty, the intricate and perplexing writing, the intricate and perplexing structures, and then the uncertain thematic points?
I think The Crying of Lot 49 is in part a book about this. There's that whole episode of the Tristero and this kind of Elizabethan drama that she's trying to unpack and see if the clue to the whole mystery is written in these right. old volumes.
A play that may be a forgery.
Right, but maybe the forgery is the one that really has the important passage. It is about, in part, why we read literature. What are we looking for? And that episode from Lot 49 is in part about that desire to turn to literature to find the purpose, the mystery, the meaning. And for me, what that book captures is, especially in the 60s, a different role of literature. Literature becomes this kind of repository for utopian thinking. Like it's a place where people go to looking not for social messages and like a diagnosis of contemporary living conditions in the city, some of the things that realism did very well, but for almost like a quasi-spiritual experience.
Right.
For the sense of connectedness.
The actual reading would be a quasi-spiritual experience?
Yeah. But dependent on fiction that's written a certain way, that's providing that. And there are a lot of those authors around that time who, even in their kind of bleakness and silliness, absurdity, are interested in the mundane connections between little things and conspiracy and, frankly, magic some of the time.
This is the voice of Georgia Tech. WREK, Atlanta.
The definition of paranoia that Pynchon seems to present is simply that everything is connected.
Right.
You know, that ultimately everything means something about everything else. And that's a complete paranoia. That's a sort of a paralytic paranoia that you then must just move through.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's almost like a Samuel Beckett play.
Yeah.
This is the intractable problem, and yet you must exist.
Right.
But that would never be what Pynchon feels like, because it is so light and confusing and hard to read. I have to confront the fact that I cannot diagnose why he is compelling, because when I try to come up with why he's compelling, it's a problem. It's a problem with the writing.
Well, that's why I think Lot 49 it's not just the place to start because it's the shortest. Although that's true. It's also that he's got something about he's condemning his own style there. Like, he's not just explaining that paranoia is this dangerous political condition where you think everything's connected. It's true. He does that. But he's also writing in a way that makes everything connected. Like you say, you see Benny Profane reappear in a couple different books. You see the Herrero. He's writing books that make it seem as if everything is connected. And this is the tricky thing about Pynchon. He's both someone who feels a lot like he's really got his finger on the pulse of a certain 60s reaction to the World War II and the consumer culture of the 50s, but also feels like a byproduct of that a lot of the time.
Right.
Is he kind of this a stoner California mentality that just wants to retreat into his conspiracy theories and it's all connected, man?
Like, that's the voice that Pynchon seems to bring out of you.
He does. Yeah. And I don't think you can pretend that he's actually totally detached from that. He is that in part.
Yeah.
Inherent Vice just sits in that voice.
Talk a little bit about Inherent Vice.
Inherent Vice, if you've read Lot 49 and you're looking for the next accessible Pynchon, it's that.
Right, yeah.
Some people would have a problem with it because it feels like Pynchon light. It doesn't seem like it's playing for the kind of stakes that a lot of the other books do.
Yeah.
It captures the playful voice. It captures the mood of a kind of Northern Californian 60s or post-60s kind of burnout stoner culture that a lot of people take to with Pynchon. It mixes the high and the low, but it's very easy reading, in part because it's built on this detective genre that we know what it feels like, even when it's not working properly.
Yeah.
And the movie captures that really nicely.
Yeah. A 50s noir.
Right.
And pushing it into the kind of dissolute, variegated California lifestyle of the late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah.
Something that is gone.
Right.
Right.
And again, there's a heavy dose of nostalgia in that.
Yeah.
It's not someone who feels like he's just critiquing this world. There's a kind of he's a pop music aficionado, right?
Yeah.
He has a really deep archival appreciation for some of the music of this era.
And he's often writing song lyrics. Right? That are sometimes great and sometimes terrible,
right,
but are always fun to read.
Yeah. But again, that's part of what defines the style, not always the success of the books, right? It's what makes Pynchon sound like Pynchon, whether it seems like there's a purpose to it or not. You're going to get the silly songs.
Yeah. And there's a kind of, it's not blasé, but there's a kind of matter of factness about the ridiculousness of sex.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, I'm putting two layers on that because, again, I have a hard time diagnosing it.
Yeah.
But there's like a streak of sexism that is somehow ameliorated by the fact that it's clear that he knows it's sexist, but he's still sort of providing this sexist kind of imagery. So I don't know. Have you grappled with that?
Yeah, a little bit. You know, it's notoriously difficult to write an earnest sex scene. There's like the bad sex scenes in literary fiction award that's given out. And when you read these, you go, oh my God, these are accomplished novelists writing truly terrible sex scenes. And the sex scene in Lot 49 is this comic absurd, like where they're putting more clothes on and it's about the oldies TV that's on in the hotel room. It's incredible in part because it's not really even a sex scene.
Yeah.
So there's that dismantling of the kind of expectations, refusing sincerity, refusing to talk about like sex as a serious topic,
right,
and making it absurd. That comes off, and it captures something that's right about that.
Yeah.
That's disarming.
Yeah, there you go. But and then the sort of the shadow to that is sometimes representation of women,
right,
is far too flat.
Yeah, well, flat, or that he's interested in the way that women become objectified by the eyes of men, and so plays that out in really intense ways that are about that. I mean, Gravity's Rainbow has a whole series of subplots about women in film and the way that film is all about this kind of male gaze on the female body, and then women who are pretending to be other women and working through the kind of sadism and masochism of these desires. And so it's really complicated and sophisticated, but in the end, yeah, it is all written from a man's point of view about these questions.
And if he was very direct and simple in his language describing each of these things, it would be juvenile.
Right.
And it would be impossible to take anything from.
Yeah.
But somehow the ornate writing and the complicated structure somehow elevates that kind of representation to a place where it can feel like it's on purpose, you know, for a cause or for a comment.
Yeah. I think one of the hardest things to talk about with Pynchon is the role that irony plays in his writing, because some of the time it's so childishly slapstick in your face that you can miss some of the much subtler ways that it's appearing. You mentioned the narrative voice. And so one of his really peculiar narrative tricks is to have the narrator be a character that you don't realize is a character until a moment where the narrator suddenly speaks to you. And those moments are, I mean, some people would say they're breaking the basic laws of how a novel should be written, and that's not wrong. But what those do to you is suddenly break what you thought of as the kind of sincere presentation of what was just happening. And those can turn your whole relationship to the tone of a scene on their head. In Gravity's Rainbow, one of the only kind of sincere moments of love, Roger and Jessica in the middle of this war, fear for bombing, and there's a line that I can't repeat now, but it's this kind of, there's just a pause where the narrator just kind of speaks on their behalf and says, like, they're in love. Leave him alone. And then the camera like pans to the next thing. And it's incredible.
Now there's the thing you just said. The camera pans to the next thing.
And he'll
just
say that. Yeah.
Yeah. There is something very cinematic and very cartoonish.
Yeah.
Right. His writing cannot escape or is insistent upon its relationship to cartoons and film.
Yeah.
And so he, I think, sometimes embodies the kind of the directorship or the animator's brush in the writing, which you don't have to do, but he loves to do.
Yeah. And for me, one of the things that both the critics and a lot of the aficionados, the Pynchonistas, who will defend every word that he's ever written, what both of them get wrong or what they miss is the role that style plays in making that happen. He's not just talking about movies and cartoons, but that's, as you've said, the way the sentences are written matters there, because he's doing things with narrative point of view based on how the camera's working. He's calling attention to that. Again, it's irony. It's the style becoming substantive.
What does irony mean in terms of literature? Because obviously, irony is something that's easy to make fun of as an idea. We have the Alanis Morissette a song to completely disrupt the meaning. And also there's the classic Reality Bites comment of, oh, it's when the literal meaning is the exact opposite of the intended meaning.
Yeah.
Which is an easy way to say irony. But then ironic writing literally in a novel is something different. Can you try to explain that a bit?
Yeah. So where that basic, the core irony, A and not A, right? It's something, but it's also not that something. Where it gets much more complicated is where it gets structural. Dramatic irony, right? The moment where Oedipus says, I'm going to kill the man who slept with my mother. And you go, oh, you probably shouldn't do that. Because you know something he doesn't know. It's no longer a kind of simple both and joke. It's not a song called Isn't It Ironic that doesn't have irony in it. It's not that simple. But it's a kind of tension between what you see happening and what you understand to be the case.
Right.
And the way that a narrative voice suddenly speaking to you, suddenly makes you realize, oh, I was treating this as omniscient, an objective, neutral point of view, and now suddenly I'm being made aware that this is a voice and a mind and a person speaking to me.
Yeah.
And that suddenly makes me say, wait a minute, how much of what I've just heard and internalized has been shaped by that subjective point of view?
And it makes you present in the writing also, the reader.
Yeah.
Now suddenly you're in conversation with someone, you're not on the outside reading the established omniscient narration.
So it doesn't make those events go away, but it suddenly adds a kind of negation of them within the story, where you have to understand that this isn't just being spoken by some godlike figure to you.
Right.
There's this filtering mechanism that is narrative. It's the narrator. It's this Pynchon voice that just appears every once in a while. One of my favorite versions of this from The Crying of Lot 49 is Oedipus at the museum, sitting in front of the painting by Remedio Vargas, and there's a sentence that says, "Oedipus, perverse, had cried."
Yes,
and I'll ask students who's calling her perverse, right? Like there's a voice calling Oedipus perverse in that moment. There's a judgment. There's just an adjectival statement about character.
Yeah,
and it's those things that. He's such a technician, and I feel like that gets lost beneath all the crazy, wacky content.
Yeah, there's a moment in Gravity's Rainbow, or several, but there's one I can remember distinctly where the narrator stutters.
Yeah.
The actual writing stutters while trying to find the word that it needs to use, which it works like a gag.
Yeah.
Like suddenly, the author is writing but then it's also important to that moment. But then Gravity's Rainbow also, Pynchon infamously said, I was quite high most of the time I wrote that. I don't know what I was doing.
Well.
Yeah, and I say infamous on purpose. Yeah. That is part of the mystique a little bit, that somehow Pynchon is uncontrollable.
Yeah.
That there is this sort of chaos within the writing that can't possibly be anything but a mad genius.
And yet, like so many of those myths of the mad genius, you forget about all of the kind of the light bulbs that didn't light before the one that did. And if I remember correctly, he wrote four novels at once. Gravity's Rainbow was one of four books he was writing at the same time.
So this is the sense that I got from pulling stuff a little bit from the, Gravity's Rainbow annotated or things.
Right.
That he was working on Gravity's Rainbow, Mason and Dixon, the Crying of Lot 49, and then possibly a lost book.
Right.
And that he said, if I get one of these right, it'll be the literary event of the century.
Yeah.
Ha ha.
Right. Now, you can say those are probably the three most impressive books he wrote, and that's an amazing feat, if that's true. but that's one of the hard things about Pynchon, that how did he... get something so right with Gravity's Rainbow, a book that deals with so many incredibly deep, rich questions that for many people is like the World War II novel. It's the book about what happens to America after World War II, what's changed.
Except it's also a novel about what happens when we lost our faith in government in the early 70s.
Yeah.
It's a Nixon-era novel written in World War II.
That has the incredible intelligence to look back and say it wasn't actually just Nixon, it was also about the economy growing as a war machine. And yeah, it's this brilliant diagnostic that also is silly in all the ways that we've described. But then some of the other books are silly in all the ways that we've described, and it's not clear what the there is. Okay, Against the Day is kind of about anarchism. It's kind of about the dynamite throwing rebellious political energies against kind of the emerging monopoly industries at the turn of the century, turn of the 20th century. But it just doesn't feel like that sticks, at least right now, in the way that talking about, let's say in 2017, a distrust and anxiety about government and its relationship to military still feels really live and important.
Yeah. We have danced around one of the books, Vineland.
Yeah.
Yeah. You should see his face, everyone. So you called that just a bad book.
I dislike that book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is it bad because it is the worst of Pynchon, or is it bad because he fails to do the things that make a book Pynchon-esque?
I think, these good, bad value judgments are always placeholders, right? You kind of have to toss them aside. The reasons, plural, that I dislike the book, one, as I've said, I don't feel like the NorCal stoner silliness comes bundled with the same kind of seriousness, the same kind of diagnostic.
Right.
What is this book for and after? What is it chasing? In a lot of ways, that book feels much more personal to me. For him, it's kind of nostalgic.
It was not a period piece, was it? It was sort of contemporary to the moment.
Yeah. It is more kind of trying to talk about Reagan in the 80s. I think that's 86, Vineland. And partially it's a book that is also starting to be a bit more conventional in the way that it's written at the level of narrative. Well, I've said called him a technician in style and sense, and praised all this. You just don't see that same kind of complexity at the level of the page. It seems like it's a book that's more worried about firing shots at the way that Californians eat pizza than it is about thinking about what a novel can do. Yeah.
And the way that Californians eat pizza is briefly an inherent vice. It's just part of the morass of stuff that gives a texture to the ultimate sort of feeling of paranoia that exists in the book.
And Inherent Vice, you can say, is a book that just commits to being more like a genre fiction. It's about the tone, the mood, the nostalgia. I feel like it just owns what it is. Whereas Vineland is torn between being this serious political diagnostic thing and a kind of indulgent stoner revelry.
Right.
And it ends up being neither. And it also has very strange, as you said, Pynchon treads on a lot of really delicate issues, and when it's done in a smart way, it's really powerful.
And when it's done in a not so smart way.
Yeah, Vineland also has these interests in film and trying to think about gender and trying to think about this relationship to the corporate state, and it does a lot of these in, I think, more ham-fisted ways.
Gotcha.
There's a kind of villain FBI agent who's uninterestingly cartoonish.
As opposed to literally interestingly cartoonish,
right?
Like a lot of Gravity's Rainbow's characters are.
Yeah. I mean, it's a different thing when you have a figure who's trying to launch V2 rockets and represents maybe that the whole history of modern scientific rationalism culminating in the V2 rocket. There's something serious that he's trying to work through there, that when you have a kind of square-jawed, big government is stepping on my territory. Your point about stand-up comics, it starts to feel libertarian. It starts to feel like a kind of simple refusal of anything that's organized or anything that touched government that stops being interesting real fast.
So it seems like if we were trying to diagnose, what's good and bad about Pynchon, when he is obvious, he's not very good.
Yeah.
And when he is obscured, he is.
Yeah.
It seems like.
Up to a point.
Yeah. I mean, there's no way to make this like a... This is not like the Nightmare on Elm Street movies where, one and three are great and two and four are bad. You know, this is just...
Yeah.
But Vineland appears to be straightforward, and it's easy to diagnose its concerns. Against the Day is... a huge, rich book, same as Gravity's Rainbow, but something about it doesn't cohere. It doesn't feel like it quite did that kind of alchemy
yeah.
that Gravity's Rainbow did.
Yeah, I would say all of the books are have a kind of order and a kind of chaos fighting against one another. And some of them are long and messy and some of them are short and tight, but does there feel like there's a purpose to right. that conflict between order and chaos? Or is it a kind of like stoner, innocent family man versus government official where the order versus chaos ends up being just kind of binary and clumsy?
Yeah. That kind of happens again in Inherent Vice a little bit.
Yeah, I think
but
so.
But they're both made more complicated. Bigfoot yeah. has a hippie in him, and Sportello has a desire to return yeah. to some authority in him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's, in a lot of ways, a rewriting of Vineland that just kind of takes that book
in a
more interesting place.
Now I got to read Vineland. We've touched on all the books except one, Bleeding Edge.
Yeah.
Perhaps we should just stick it with a pin, but we should speak on each of the books. So Bleeding Edge, you said...
I got 100 pages in and quit, which
why?
I'm not proud to say. Well, but so this is interesting. Again, it sounds like Pynchon. I mean, it's a detective-ish story that once again has got the music references. But this is that interesting admission where part of what's appealing about Pynchon is the nostalgia, that retro right. 60s, 70s in Northern California. And when Bleeding Edge is... In the first 100 pages, you got Britney Spears references.
Right.
You've got slightly confused like Jay-Z versus Nas debates yeah. about 90s-ish hip-hop.
9/11 is an event kind of in the middle of the book.
Right.
That's the time period.
Yeah. And again, you can say this fits the pattern. He writes pseudo-historical fiction that's always kind of the present looking at the past.
Yeah.
So it's not an outlier in that way, but... I didn't find myself wanting Pynchon's style and skill set applied to that kind of contemporary moment, you know. And again, I'll reread it at some point in time.
Is that why you said you're a little embarrassed to say? Because there's sort of a snobbiness to the way that you pulled away from the book.
It is, and it's I have 100-page rules. Like I don't quit before 100 pages, and I don't do that very often. But I've fallen out of love. I'll just admit that.
Yeah.
Like yeah, and I've gotten into this. Argument with what I've called the Pynchonistas.
Yeah.
After Mason Dixon, Inherent Vice is fun. I think it works for what it is, but I just don't. None of those books are books that I would go back to and reread.
Well, let's remember one of the things we must all do in life is shake off the desire to be a bootlicker.
So, yeah. You know,
No one is perfect, and no one is great because of who they are.
Right. And I don't have as a professional critic, I don't have the predisposition to be a fan first anyway.
Right.
But yeah, I'm also someone who has stacks and stacks of books to read. And so there's this simple test of would I ever go back and reread
it? Is it worth my time?
Yeah, really. Or would I teach it, right, is another way of employing that test.
We've got just a little bit of time left. So let's talk about that, how Pynchon interacts with your profession or your professional identity. For me, I'm just reading Pynchon for fun.
Yeah.
You know, to my great regret, he, reignited my desire to write novels myself.
Oh, yeah.
And I have been suffering ever since. But you teach literature, mm-hmm. and as you said, you're a professional critic in a way. So how does that shape how you engage his texts?
I would say Lot 49 is... maybe not the only teachable Pynchon. It's certainly the only Pynchon I've ever taught and ever had any real compulsion to teach, other than maybe the short story Entropy, which is a standout for me of the slow learner book that we mentioned.
Okay.
Lot 49, 180 pages. When we say teachable professionally, it means can you fit this in a syllabus? Can
right,
it functionally
right.
be in terms of time, in terms of what the students are bringing to whatever class it is, approached, handled in 50-minute chunks,
right.
and then left behind for whatever comes next.
So just to make sure we ring that bell, like most of his books are too long
yeah.
to teach in a class
yeah.
and are too hard to read to be able to just kind of get to the meat
yeah.
quickly enough in the
yeah.
class. Yeah.
And I'll add in the payoff. When you put something on a syllabus, you need to have a reason it's there. And so that's why I've referred to teachability or rereading. I would never assign against the day, not just because it's 1,100 pages, but because I wouldn't be able to articulate what it is I wanted my students to get out of
yeah.
that. Gravity's Rainbow is the hard one because it's an incredible book, but the barrier to entry, the threshold for approaching and understanding that book is enormous.
Have you read any dissertations about Gravity's Rainbow?
Yeah.
Yeah. How do those come off?
Gravity's Rainbow is it's a black hole for literary criticism. I mean, so much is written about it, especially right in the 80s and 90s, in the height kind of chasing postmodernism era. Pynchon inspires such devotion, especially among, you know, grad students who are obsessive about literature. They get into the cult of personality. They start chasing all the details. But again, as I've said, for me, part of what's interesting about Pynchon is that he's telling you that chasing the details is the trap, right? he's warning you, as Joyce warned people, as when Joyce finished Ulysses, I've written a novel that the professors can worry over for 100 years. I'm getting that wrong.
But that was the general intent. He was saying, here, I know that this is something that will make people try to understand it.
And that is, at least in the early part of the 20th century, that's a whole new way of thinking about what a novel is and what reading should be. And Pynchon does that all across the board. You could spend the rest of your life writing analyses of how things are connected. But to me, that's like partially missing the point of the danger of paranoid thinking and conspiracy. So yeah, people fall down the hole of the encyclopedic novel, quote unquote, of trying to compare Ulysses and Gravity's Rainbow or Finnegan's Wake and these monsters.
Encyclopedic novel meaning simply a novel that appears to pull in all of the information of its time.
Which is a nonsense category. I mean, there's no such novel.
They're just trying to explain Moby Dick.
No, exactly. Everyone's still trying to deal with Moby Dick. And the books that get lumped into this, Don Quixote and The Man Without Qualities, they're just not. You know, even Moby Dick may be the most of all time. I mean, but it's idiosyncratic, and that's partially the point. And Ulysses is Joyce writing a book only Joyce would understand already, and that's part of the point. It's not an encyclopedia. It's not a reference work. So that term just professionally drives me crazy.
So have you taught Lot 49 yet?
Yes, I have. I taught it in Germany, in fact, which was a trip, because I think I was ready to teach a postmodern version of that where it's about the undecidability and it's about paranoia. But the students in Germany read this thing and they went, oh, this is so California. This is so much, or at least it's so much what we think of California being.
Were you teaching in German or were you English? Teaching in English.
Okay, and so it's in an American studies program, which because of World War II, Germany has a really strong American studies sets of programs. And so I was teaching in one of these, and they really wanted to know, like, what's going on in California that makes this kind of book possible?
So it was a travel log to them in a way. It was a cultural artifact.
And I was coming from the University of California, which, okay, I'm not a Californian, and in California I certainly didn't feel like one, but to them, here's this emissary from California teaching this wacky book about California in the 50s and 60s.
You've seen the ocean from that beach.
Exactly. tell us what's California about. And that was really when I started to have a kind of third wave of a relationship to Pynchon was a lot of what I'm saying now that's about kind of historicizing him and making him political and not falling into his own traps. Of just talking about, for me, Lot 49 is a book about California politics. It's about the new left being the thing that everyone remembers, but actually the new right being the legacy that matters from the early 60s. And it's there in the background. Edipa is walking around the campus on Berkeley and seeing all these kind of lefty, free speech movement this and ecological that, but she can't. There are all of these acronyms for right-wing groups that she doesn't recognize, and they're there up on posters. And the John Birch Society is there, if you remember, in the background.
Right.
And so I taught it as a kind of, in a way that it doesn't get taught a lot, a social history about California being this place where people given over to paranoid thinking and conspiracy could seem like stoner hippie lefties.
Right.
And yet the same paranoia became a weapon of the right, who actually ended up using it a lot more effectively over the last 50 years than the burnout stoners did. And it went so well. I've got an essay on that experience. It was really terrific, yeah.
I think that's a perfect place to end, despite the little bit of pessimism in the, but the fact that it was a good experience. So,
well, I can add, I'm teaching it again for the first time in several years this spring in an American Studies class, first time I've ever taught it in the States. And so I won't immediately have that same kind of access to the, this is California. I don't know that students in North Georgia care about California.
You will have to figure out a word that describes your experience so we can talk about it.
Happily, yeah.
Ian, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thanks, Charlie.